Israel is not likely in control of the escalation of this war. And I think it's important to understand that Iran has prepared for this escalation and prepared these groups for an escalation.
That's military historian Kimberly Kagan on the challenge of keeping the conflict in Gaza from spiraling into a regional war between Israel and Iran.
We are already seeing right now that the war is wider than just Gaza and Israel.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
The conflict in Ukraine and the conflict in the Middle East are deeply connected, and they're connected by our adversaries.
Dr. Kimberly Kagan is the founder and president of the Institute for the Study of War, and she served as a key advisor to top military commanders during the troop surges in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now her organization is compiling open-source analysis of military conflicts aimed at helping policymakers, the press, and the public better understand events on the ground.
The issue in 2023 is very different from understanding conflict, say, in 1943. The complicated feature is sorting out what is truth from many competing different sources.
That means assessing the global stakes of the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine can still prevail in its conflict against Russia, and it must prevail. That's actually incredibly important, not for Ukraine, but actually for the United States and for its European allies.
As well as sounding an alarm about the state of the U.S. military in an increasingly dangerous world.
The United States is not prepared for conflict on the scale that we are beginning to see around the world.
Dr. Kimberly Kagan, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you.
You are a military historian, the founder and president of the Institute for the Study of War, and an author. You worked closely with the Department of Defense under President Bush and President Obama, and you advised General David Petraeus in Kabul for 17 months during the Afghanistan war. Currently, there are two major wars underway, the Israel-Hamas war and Russia's Ukraine war. Describe the mission of the Institute for the Study of War against the backdrop of these conflicts.
The Institute for the Study of War exists to help civilian leaders, policymakers, military leaders, and journalists, and the American public understand what is happening in conflict zones around the world and be able to follow what is happening on the ground. ISW believes that policy and strategy should be formulated on the basis of ground reality and that getting to that ground truth is essential for all of us. Policymakers need ground truth in order to make informed decisions. And we as citizens need ground truth in order to hold our policymakers accountable. And so ISW has a program by which it conducts what we call open source intelligence analysis of conflicts around the world. That means we use unclassified sources in order to take a look at conflicts that are ongoing in places like Ukraine and create maps and daily reporting about what's happening on the ground that our fellow journalists, newspapers, military personnel here in the United States, and indeed worldwide, actually use in order to understand what's happening on the ground, but also in order to talk about it with their populations.
Talk about how you gather open source information, the advantages and the disadvantages to intelligence that is available to everyone.
So one of the transformational features of warfare in the modern age is that so much of it is actually documented publicly through social media and also is available and accessible to us. So the issue in 2023 is very different from understanding conflict, say, in 1943. In 2023, through what it is that militaries, civilians put on the internet, we can actually learn a lot about what's going on the ground. The complicated feature is sorting out what is truth from many competing different sources. And so what we do at ISW with our intelligence analysis teams is use methodologies that our intelligence community folks would use, people who are working in agencies, in order to parse out good information from bad information, and in order to verify that information. So let me give you an example from the ground in Ukraine.
Please, yeah.
One of the ways that we follow the war in Ukraine is through watching or listening to how it is that the Russians talk about combat operations in Ukraine. And in particular, there are ultra-nationalist Russians who are blogging about the war. They don't tell the truth, but some of what they comment on and publish on actually has latent information in it. And we can use a whole suite of new kinds of tools that allow us to verify that information. So whereas governments in the past were the only ones who had access to things like satellite imagery, over the past 5 years, that satellite imagery is now available commercially. And a lot of it is available at less cost than it was 10 or 20 years ago. We can use that satellite imagery to verify whether a report is confirmed and whether other evidence that is out there on the internet is confirmable. We can geolocate pictures to see whether an event happened at a specific place. And we can use things such as the system of remote sensors that NASA has that detects forest fires. It actually reveals where there are significant episodes of ground combat and exchanges of fire. And so by deploying this range of tools, we can actually help to verify what's useful from the open internet, and we can rule out things that are falsified. That helps us create the maps that we produce every day that show where the Russians or where the Ukrainians are controlling ground in Ukraine.
Can you explain why there is a need for independent open source information and advice from outside the military chain of command in conflicts like Ukraine, or even in conflicts like Afghanistan and Iraq, where you advised four-star generals?
So one would think that the U.S. government would be able to talk about what is happening on the ground in conflict zones. And indeed, it can. The intelligence that our U.S. government has is exquisite, and we have tremendous intelligence professionals. But they can talk only to themselves using their classified information. And so that means that it's actually very difficult in our democracy for those of us who do not have access to classified information to follow along what is happening on the ground. Furthermore, the United States relies on the partnership of countries around the world, some of whom are formal allies, and may have access to shared intelligence, and some of whom are partners who don't have access to shared intelligence. And it becomes very complicated in a war zone or in international diplomacy, actually, to share a picture of what we know and discuss in common terms what is happening on the ground. We at ISW produce a daily map and daily intelligence analysis of the conflict on the ground in Ukraine. And the Ukrainian government has used it to brief European leaders, such as the leader of Germany and the leader of France, because it's shareable. There is no classified intelligence involved in our product, and it makes it possible for all parties actually to understand what's happening. That's a use case for open source intelligence that increases global transparency, but it also increases the strength of our alliances and partnerships. In Afghanistan and Iraq, where I had the privilege to spend time as a volunteer with General Petraeus and then his successor, General John Allen, one of the values of the open source intelligence is that it enables us to look at the world not through the lens of a small soda straw that we can point here or there, which is what happens with exquisite intelligence. Exquisite intelligence looks at very specific things. Government leaders ask specific questions, and the intelligence answers that. Open source intelligence can allow all of us to look at problem sets that are not necessarily the right problem sets for our government to devote exquisite and classified sources to. And it allows us to ask questions that perhaps the U.S. government or allied governments have not prioritized.
Well, listen, I know the majority of your work at the moment focuses on Ukraine, and you also have a deep expertise in Iran. I'd like to ask you first about Israel and the Israel-Hamas war, and then move on to some of these other areas that you're in, which you're deeply resourced. First, as you know, Israel has launched the second phase of its military campaign, the ground invasion, with troops now advancing towards Gaza City. How do you assess the evolution of the conflict so far?
So the war began on October 7th when Hamas conducted a series of widespread terrorist attacks against civilian and military targets in Israel. And those attacks were brutal. And it is not surprising that the Israelis then declared war. What is interesting about the military operations as they are unfolding is that Israel has mobilized a lot of forces, both in the area around Gaza, but in other parts of Israel, and has designed and is executing a very deliberate campaign to essentially surround parts of Gaza with military forces, to cut off Gaza really in its middle from the Israeli inland to the sea, and to take steps to begin to isolate Gaza City from the agricultural areas around the outside of Gaza City. It's much slower than typical Israeli military campaigns. It's quite deliberate. And it is really only just begun. And so what we're watching is a patient setting of conditions by the Israeli military. And it is not yet clear how much fighting the Israelis will encounter as they approach Gaza City itself.
It is presumed that the next stage of the conflict will likely involve intense urban combat, perhaps block by block against enemies in entrenched and dense populations. There are military experts who have likened this upcoming battle to the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq that was known as a house-by-house battle. You understand the Battle of Fallujah and have studied it. Do you see that as a fair comparison or an apt comparison?
There are certainly some features of the urban warfare that U.S. forces encountered in Iraq that are apposite to the situation that Israel is likely to face in Gaza. So urban combat is difficult. It's tough. It's tough in part because there is a dense civilian population and obviously a dense set of buildings in any urban area. So when we take a look at the challenge that the Israeli military faces as it approaches Gaza City, we do have to be aware that urban combat is difficult. Now, there are some features of how Hamas has fought its past wars that I think are important to keep in mind and may make the situation a bit different from what went on in Fallujah. Hamas has been typically a lighter force, and we have yet to see how it will fight in these densely populated urban areas. What we saw in Fallujah over time was indeed a very dug-in enemy that was optimized for the defense of a city. And that is what al-Qaeda in Iraq did. And it defended the city very, very thoroughly, which is why our U.S. Marines and soldiers had a difficult time clearing it. Urban combat is not impossible, though. It's just hard, and it can be casualty intensive for all combatants. So there are some features of what the Israelis are now doing that are important. First of all, they are actually conducting a very deliberate approach to the city. I think that shows careful planning. The second thing that we are observing that is interesting and important is the way in which the Israeli forces are able to combine arms and branches of military service. So they have their air support, and they have a ground combat operation. They have infantry and tanks and artillery. They have rotary wing helicopters that are supporting their forces. And in military history, it is the ability to combine these different types of capabilities that can be a significant advantage to a modern combatant. And so we'll see whether the Israelis are able to bring that suite of military skills to bear and whether Hamas has a sophisticated defense of Gaza set up that it is prepared to launch.
What did you mean by Hamas as a light force?
When we speak of light forces in a military, we really mean that a force does not actually have tanks or heavy armored vehicles. So when we're taking a look at some of the things that the Israeli ground forces have? Well, they have tanks. They have armored vehicles that can move personnel. Hamas, in contrast, doesn't have tanks. And this is an important feature of this battlefield. And look, Hamas has typically used its military forces and capabilities in two ways. On the one hand, limited ground incursions into Israel. And then it has an intensive rocket force that it uses. So it is a light force with a heavy artillery component. That's what I mean by light force.
How do you also account for the extensive network of tunnels beneath Gaza that have been used over the past decades to smuggle food and people and weapons? From a military standpoint, how do those tunnels pose a challenge to this kind of urban warfare?
Yeah, the tunnel system in Gaza is extremely extensive, and it creates of course, all battlefields are exist in 3D, but one of the most interesting features of this battlefield is that it will have an air, a ground, and a subterranean component because the tunnels are used in order to relay supplies and troops to headquarter units, leaders, and equipment. And it means that there are ways for Hamas actually to reinforce different areas of the city without actually coming above ground. And that means that there are complex challenges to this fight. Now, we have seen that in other areas of combat. And so I think it's important to say that the tunneling system that Hamas has is extremely extensive. But in the Syrian civil war, we did see many of the Iranian-backed groups actually tunneling through cities of Syria. So that this dimension of war, the subterranean dimension of war at which Hamas clearly excels, is something that they've actually exported to other battlefields. It does make urban combat more difficult. But again, it puts a greater burden on intelligence and it puts a greater burden on very deliberate clearing operations.
So Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned in a Wall Street Journal opinion editorial this week of Iran's axis of terror. And of course, he was referring to Iran's proxies, from Hamas in Gaza to Hezbollah in Lebanon to the Houthis in Yemen. And scholars such as yourself refer to this axis as the axis of resistance. You have been tracking these activities of militant groups for years now. Help us understand what Iran's goals are in supporting these military proxy groups.
So Iran has some overarching objectives that we need to keep in mind. One is Iran has declared that the United States is its enemy. And one of Iran's objectives is expelling the United States from the Middle East. Secondly, Iran has as its stated objective the destruction of the state of Israel. Third, Iran has as a major objective bringing its brand of theocratic rule to other states in the Middle East. And so within that framework, Iran has assembled a coalition of state and non-state actors throughout the Middle East on which it relies to help do those three things.
Is the bottom line in your analysis that Iran is seeking a broader conflict now?
Iran has prepared for a broader conflict now and has been actively preparing that axis of resistance for a broader conflict for several years.
Is there any way then to contain the current conflict as it is now between just Israel and Gaza and prevent it from expanding, for example, to Hezbollah, to Israel's northern border, as you just mentioned?
Iran and its axis of resistance are largely in control of the escalation of this war. The United States is not likely in control of the escalation of this war. Israel is not likely in control of the escalation of this war. And I think it's important to understand that Iran has prepared for this escalation and prepared these groups for an escalation.
So as you then consider that and scenarios for what a wider conflict could look like, what do you assess is likely to be the next set of developments in this war?
So we are already seeing right now that the war is wider than just Gaza and Israel. And so I think it's important to recognize that some of the Iranian groups that are essentially members of this axis of resistance are already engaged against U.S. forces in places such as Iraq and Syria. And so we have seen the targeting of U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. And that is consistent with what Iran has been preparing for. And it is in part a signal to the United States that Iran is willing to escalate the war. And it's in part a threat to the United States that Iran will escalate the war. So we're focused right now very tightly on what the Israel-Gaza portion of the war looks like, but the regional actors are already signaling.
You know, you said Iran is preparing for a wider conflict. Is that what Iran wants?
I can't state what Iran wants. I think that Iran has prepared for a wider conflict for several reasons, including that the aspirations that it has for the region include the expulsion of U.S. forces and the destruction of Israel.
Let me ask you about Ukraine. You've spent a huge amount of time and resources on understanding Ukraine and bringing visibility and transparency to the fighting in Ukraine. First, help us understand, Ukraine launched a counteroffensive against Russia in June and has reclaimed some territory, but progress has been slow on both sides, and both sides have suffered incredibly severe losses. Why did the summer counteroffensive not deliver the results that many observers anticipated who were supporting Ukraine?
The Ukrainian summer counteroffensive has turned out to be more difficult than I think even the Ukrainians themselves thought.
Why is that? Did they not have good open source information, Kim?
I know that they had our open source information. Part of war is the reality that until forces actually make contact, you don't know what the outcome will be. That's not a very satisfactory explanation, so let me dig further. The Ukrainians and the Russians both prepared for a counteroffensive, both prepared for the Ukrainians actually to undertake a counteroffensive in the summer. The Russians prepared for that by digging trenches and fortifications throughout that part of southern Ukraine that it was most likely that the Ukrainians would try to take back. And that is the area around Zaporizhia is the area where the main combat has taken place. And look, Ukraine's south is very important. It's fertile area. It is key agricultural land. Ukraine's a grain basket of the world. And that southern land is also something that the Russians have been using to connect mainland Russia with Crimea and keep supplies going between the two. So it's not surprising that the Ukrainians attacked where they did because that was the obvious area in which to attack. But the Russians prepared defenses. And those defenses were entrenched, and they were they're quite thoroughly mined in depth. And so as the Ukrainian forces tried to advance, they came into dense minefields and then met Russian forces that defended their trenches pretty well. They didn't collapse like the Russian forces did in Kherson and Kharkiv, the two areas where the Ukrainians conducted a successful counteroffensive in 2022. Now, there are reasons why the Ukrainians struggled. The minefields are one. But there are ways to get around and through minefields. The Russians also brought to bear two things on this battlefield that I think are very important. One, electronic warfare. That is the ability actually to make it difficult for the Ukrainians to use certain kinds of precision systems. And a second is drones. And both Ukraine and Russia have proliferated drones, and they are densely packed in this sector. So it has been very bloody, and the Ukrainians do not have some things that are very important for overcoming minefields, drones, and dense fortifications. And those include long-range precision weapons. A second thing that they lack is air power. It is therefore difficult for the Ukrainians actually to make advances. And so that's why I think that they have struggled. And I think, though, it's actually important to note that both the Ukrainians and the Russians are learning and adapting on this battlefield. And just because the Ukrainian counteroffensive did not go as planned, does not actually mean that the Russians have won the war or that the Ukrainians have lost the war. It means that there is more combat coming and that there is a lot of adaptation that is going on that we may actually see emerge over the winter and the spring of 2024.
You have said in September that the war is winnable by Ukraine. In your analysis, Dr. Kagan, what is the path for Ukraine to prevail?
Ukraine can still prevail in its conflict against Russia, and it must prevail. That's actually incredibly important, not for Ukraine, but actually for the United States and for its European allies.
Make that case.
We have a Russia brutally invaded Ukraine with no justification in order to subjugate Ukraine politically and in order to cleanse Ukraine of its language, ethnicity, and culture. And the war that is underway is a war that Putin undertook as a war of choice. And its goals are to remove an independent state from the European continent. Well, that is unacceptable to the United States, to its allies, and indeed to the free world. We cannot allow brutal states to remove independent states by force, by invading them, by overturning their governments. And if the United States does not stand up against brutal aggression to eliminate sovereign states, then other authoritarian regimes with territorial ambitions will learn from Putin's invasion of Ukraine that the world is a free-for-all. And I think Xi Jinping in China is watching very closely what the United States is doing in Ukraine and what European states are doing in Ukraine, and whether or not Putin will be allowed to get away with the conquest of part of the lands of another state. What happens in Ukraine is so important for what happens in Taiwan. And it is so important for whether or not we can live in a peaceful and prosperous world.
Let me ask you, Hamas and Russia have long maintained close ties. Since its 2022 invasion of Ukraine, Moscow has continued to deepen its ties with Hamas's backer, Iran. How, in your analysis, are these two conflicts connected?
So the conflict in Ukraine and the conflict in the Middle East are deeply connected. And they're connected by our adversaries. The Russians have relied on Iranian drones as a key component of their ability to sustain the war in Ukraine. But I think it's important to remember that the relationship between Iran and Russia is not new. The military relationship between Iran and Russia is not new. It goes back, actually, to the Syrian civil war. And it tightened as a result of the Russians entering the Syrian civil war directly as a combatant. And back in 2015, when the Iranians and Hezbollah were still struggling to maintain their support for the Assad regime and give it the ability to survive, the Russians entered the Syrian civil war as a combatant and brought Russian air power to the Syrian civil war. And the Russians and Iranians, Hezbollah and other members of the Iranian Axis of Resistance began to operate together in 2015. They had some headquarters that were co-located, and they became what we would call in military lingo interoperable. They were able to design, plan, and conduct military operations together in urban settings by bringing together the ground combat power of Lebanese Hezbollah and the air power that the Russians had. This is a very deep relationship. And the shared goal that Iran and Russia had was to preserve the Assad regime and to expel the United States from the region. What we have seen since 2015 is a maturing of that relationship. The militaries have gotten more interoperable with one another. But in addition, the power relationship has changed. Whereas Russia was the bigger, badder power in 2015, Russia is now focused on Ukraine, and Iran has more leverage in the relationship with Russia than it did previously.
To what extent is Iran supporting Russia's efforts in Ukraine now?
Iran is providing many of the drones that the Russians are using, especially in their attacks on critical infrastructure around Ukraine's cities. So Iran has Shahed drones. They're capable. And the Russians rely on those drones and have relied on those drones for campaigns like the one we saw in winter of 2022 to 23, when they targeted the Ukrainian power grid, when the Russians targeted the Ukrainian power grid in order to create discontent among Ukrainian civilians with their government. So the Russians are actually highly dependent on these Iranian drones for some of what they are doing. And the Russians are looking to be able to produce this type of drone inside of Russia, but they still rely on the Iranians providing this capability as of now. So they're intimately tied. Iran is supplying weapons of combat to the Russians in Ukraine.
Russian and Israeli ties have also been strong over the years, going back to the conflict in Syria. How do you see this relationship changing, given the recent developments in Israel?
I think that the Israeli government has always hoped that Russia would provide some check on Iranian behavior in Syria. We at ISW have assessed that that check has not been effective. But be that as it may, it has been Israeli policy to tolerate Russia's presence inside of Syria. I don't think that this myth is going to last very long. I think that Putin is going to have to make a choice soon between whether he will maintain his relationship with Iran or whether he will maintain his relationship with Israel. And Putin needs Iran in order to sustain his war in Ukraine. And Putin needs the Chechen militias that are fighting in Ukraine and keeping peace in his Muslim lands in order for his regime to survive. And so Putin is going to end up facing a tough choice. I think he's going to try to delay that choice as long as he can. But since his war in Ukraine is so important to him and the survival of his regime, he is going to have to optimize his alliance relationship to be able to continue to sustain that war. And I think the Israelis are going to find that Putin is not a helpful or friendly actor.
So in plain speak, in your analysis, Putin is likely to double down and support Iran.
Putin does not want to choose between Iran and Israel, but right now, because of the war in Ukraine, Iran is more important to Putin, and Putin will end up choosing Iran because he needs the Iranian weapons in order to be able to continue his war in Ukraine.
What lessons from the war in Ukraine do you expect Israel or Hamas to have implemented in their operational and tactical planning?
Super question, Margaret. Can I start by talking about some of the important differences between what we see in Ukraine and what we're seeing in the Middle East?
Sure.
So one difference between the war in Ukraine and the war in the Middle East, at least as it stands now, is the scale of the war. The Ukrainians are defending a 1,000-kilometer front line against the Russian invasion. And when we're talking about the war in Israel and Gaza, we have to remember that the size, at least of Gaza, is smaller than the size of Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. So the scale of the war is very different from one theater to another. A second difference between the war in Ukraine and the war in Gaza is that the war in Ukraine is being fought by two relatively evenly matched forces that have a lot of conventional ground capability. They fight conventionally on the ground. They have armor. They have trucks. And so what we see between Israel and Hamas is a conventional military in Israel that is very high tech, fighting a less conventional, lighter force. A third difference is that the Israelis are a modern force. They have some things that the Ukrainians don't. They have air power. Ukraine has no air power, or it has very limited air power. The Israelis have long-range precision strike. They have the ability to deal with electronic warfare on the battlefield. They have the ability to use helicopters and all sorts of things that the Ukrainians just can't do. They don't have the skills and equipment and training, let alone the supplies from Europe or the United States actually to conduct this kind of warfare. And so the Israelis have an advantage that the Ukrainians don't. And that advantage comes from this air power, this technology, and their long-range strikes. Why do I think this is important? Well, we talked earlier about the ways in which the Russians and Ukrainians were fighting across minefields that the Ukrainians could not penetrate. We may see a different kind of war in between Israel and Hamas. We don't know yet. The advanced capabilities that Israel has may allow Israel to circumvent some of the most difficult parts of the kinds of drone-heavy, ground-heavy warfare that we've seen in Ukraine. We're not going to know, though, until later on in the Israeli military operation.
Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history, was on this program with William F. Buckley Jr. in 1986 when he was Israel's ambassador to the UN, and Buckley asked him to define terrorism.
Let me let me try to give an instance of what terrorism is not. In 1944, the British Royal Air Force sets out on a bombing mission. The target is the Gestapo headquarters in Copenhagen. Perfect target. The planes loose the bombs, drop the bombs, and they miss. Instead of the Gestapo headquarters, they hit a children's hospital, and scores of children are horribly killed. This is an accidental, tragic outcome of war. This can happen, but it is not terrorism. Because what terrorists do is target the innocent deliberately. And therefore, my definition of terrorism is the systematic and deliberate attack, the murder, maiming, and menacing of innocence of civilians for political goals.
What do you make of that, Kim?
Hamas began this war through a major act of terrorism on the 7th of October, going and killing and kidnapping innocent civilians in Israel, slaughtering babies. Those are acts of terror, without any doubt.
And you've dealt with this question of civilians deliberately being targeted, as well as civilians who have been tragic casualties in war in Ukraine and Afghanistan and in Iraq. Of course, this is even more complicated during the current conflict since Gaza is so densely populated and Hamas operates within civilian areas. Let me ask you about something you wrote in 2020. You wrote that the U.S. national defense strategy was at a, quote, inflection point. And you argued that the U.S. was inadequately preparing for future conflicts by falling behind in the race to prepare, quote, intellectually, doctrinally, and organizationally for wars of present and future. What is your biggest concern?
The United States is not prepared for conflict on the scale that we are beginning to see around the world. The United States is used to having the world's most outstanding, dominating armed force. And it is used to being able to use that armed force with limited casualties. What we are observing now is that enemies and adversaries of the United States are preparing for war, whether we're talking about Russia or whether we're talking about Iran or whether we're talking about China. And they're preparing for modern war. And they're looking at the United States. And although they may have some very different goals, they share the goal of making sure that the United States is not able to be powerful in this world. And they share the goal of destroying our way of life, our freedom, our values, our prosperity. And so this is what I'm afraid of. The United States has not invested enough in its defense. We have not modernized our armed forces for the conflicts that are coming. And we do not have enough troops, weapons, equipment for the kinds of wars that we're seeing right now. The war in Ukraine should be a wake-up call for all of us. The amount of artillery and ammunition that both the Russians and the Ukrainians are using is depleting stocks of munitions around the world. These conflicts that we are likely to face in the future can be numerous, dispersed, technologically advanced, and brutal. And the United States still has a very small force that is prepared to go in and to be unopposed in expelling the army of Saddam Hussein from Kuwait in 1991. That's what our forces were designed to do.
Mm. Yeah.
The United States needs to get real. We do not have the industrial capacity, the defense industrial capacity to produce weapons and equipment at the scale that modern war is likely to require. We do not desire war, but our enemies and adversaries have a say. They will choose where and when they fight. And the United States has interests in the world around it. We rely on free trade around the globe. We rely on open society. We rely on an open internet and a free and prosperous way of life. We're going to need to defend that way of life as enemies and adversaries challenge it. And the time to recognize that those enemies and adversaries are preparing the challenge is right now, as China's military is modernizing, as the Russians, the Iranians, the Chinese, and the North Koreans are forming practical alignments that allow mutual resupply of armaments. The time to recognize that the United States has to invest in its defense is not when the war begins, but now, so that the United States can continue to deter aggression and protect itself without actually having to use that military force at a large scale.
Dr. Kagan, thank you for joining me on Firing Line.
Thank you, Margaret. It's been a pleasure.